Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Episode 66 of a radio show with pictures mounted on a shoestring, which only happened because of my cockamamie dismissal by a local radio station in London, now has an audience of 1 million people across the globe, more than 700,000 of them in black and white, in print, on Facebook, on YouTube, on Twitter, and on Instagram, and on Twitch. This is a phenomenon. This is truly a global university, and I'm honoured that you are trusting me as your professor. And in return, I promise that we will deal, continue to deal, with the subjects that nobody else deals with, and in a way that no one else ever will. You're all paying the BBC, if you've got a television, that is. You'll go to prison if you don't. Or you're paying through advertising if you're only watching commercial television. Thanks to RT and Sputnik, you're not paying for this at all. Although, we'll be starting next month a midweek Mother of All Talk Shows that you will have to pay $1 or whatever the sterling equivalent is next month, probably 75 or 76 pence. And that will be the Mother of All Talk Shows truly unleashed, unplugged. Not that we're censored in any way here, but we will be, I don't know, more zany, more edgy, and we'll deal with the very, very sharpest of issues. So if you're one of those watching, please, I urge you now, please share it with everyone, because I quite like it up here on this cloud, as you've probably already inferred. Now, the coronavirus pandemic not only isn't going away, it's coming back. It's coming back in a serious way. Now, that doesn't mean that the death toll that we experienced at one stage in Britain, though we deliberately concealed it, we covered it up, we were losing 1,000 people a day for a period in Britain. Now we're not. And despite the massive spike in cases, doubling every week, we will not necessarily go back to that level of death toll, but we might. What if we do? What's going to happen in the economy if we plunge back into general lockdown? Will we even be allowed to go to work? You know my view, as the apocryphal Irishman said when asked directions to Dublin, he said, I wouldn't have started from here. Well, I wouldn't. I told you right from the beginning what we should have been doing and how long we should have been doing it. And the government did very differently. We locked down too late. We lifted the lockdown too early. We did not test and track and trace. We forced people back to work in unsafe conditions. But our economy fell by 20% in one quarter, the biggest single fall since the British economy existed. That fall cannot be afforded again. So what are we going to do now? Everybody knows about the chaos in testing. At least everyone on this side of the Atlantic knows that our government cannot be trusted to go out for a loaf, never mind to safeguard the National Health Service and the public health of 65 million people. You wouldn't trust them to go out to the shops for you. If you were in any doubt about that, then you haven't read the excerpts of Diary of an MP's Wife, which perfectly sums up the calibre of the British political class today. This tome, this diary, is serialised everywhere. I'm reading about it everywhere I turn. It's written by the nondescript wife of an entirely nondescript Member of Parliament, who was an entirely nondescript minister, briefly, in David Cameron's government. His name is Hugo Swire. I forget his wife's name. Her book spells out the banality, the utter nondescriptness of the people running our country. It can be summed up by her relaying, not denied by David Cameron, that as he took her for a walk with her husband in the gardens of Chequers, the country home of the Prime Minister, the Eton and Oxford-educated Prime Minister of Great Britain said to his friend's wife, "I'd like to take you in those bushes and give you one." Boris Johnson, at a number 10 Downing Street dinner, complete with candelabra and white linen and silver spoons, shouted across the table at the aforementioned Hugo Swire, then a minister in the British Foreign Office, God help us, "Hey, Hugo, did you shag Jerry Hall?" That's the kind of people running our country. That's the kind of people who were running it under David Cameron. It's the kind of people that are running it under Boris Johnson. They all went to the same school. They all went to the same university. They have the same cultural level, which is on ground level, if not on basement level. They all talk to women like that. They all care only about being in power. As another ex-Foreign Office Minister, George Walden, says in the papers today, these people come from such a bubble, such a tiny sliver of the British society, that they literally have no idea, which is why they thought Brexit would never pass. They actually have no idea what life looks like, sounds like, is like in the country as a whole. They live their lives from school, through university, and into the professions on a cloud. But it is a cloud that is about to open. And Britain is about to face economic and political challenges which have not been matched since the summer of 1940, when our brave pilots, together with our Commonwealth and other allied pilots, in that battle of Britain, saved this country from fascist invasion and being subsumed in the Third Reich of Adolf Hitler. We have not faced a crisis like that until now. It's not that the coronavirus can be necessarily compared to Hitler, but it could be. If the pandemic were to go up several gears, which it could do, if the economy were to collapse by another 20%, in this coming quarter, then the threat to our national life, our livelihood, and the well-being of our people would be existential. The Britain that would come out the other end of that, if there is a coming out at the other end of that, would be almost unthinkable. There could be a collapse of social peace in this country. There could be a revolution in this country. Probably not a good revolution. But the first casualty of it will undoubtedly be Boris Johnson, who is posted missing in dispatches. He is simply not on top of his brief, neither of the economy nor of the public health situation. In fact, he personally has made it far worse. His government handing out £100 billion or more in public money to private companies who have utterly failed to carry out the projects for which they were paid have put us in this potential disaster now, where nobody can get a test, let alone be tested and tracked and traced. We cannot gather in our homes in more than six, but we can sit in a pub with 600, but only till 10 o'clock. We are paid to eat out. Just 2 weeks ago, if that, eat out to help out, which may well have accelerated the spread again of this virus. They're even letting people into rugby games, but not football ones. Limited crowds, but crowds nonetheless. None of this makes any sense, is my point. None of this has any logic. And we have a crisis in Britain of numbers, of statistics. Nobody knows whether they can believe the statistics. Nobody knows if they can believe the scientists. Now, all of this is true of Britain, and it's true with knobs on in the United States of America, where anybody who believed the government, anybody who believed the statistics, anybody who believed the science would need their head examined. This is a state that spent the last 4 years talking about Russiagate while their country fell apart and was set on fire, either by global warming in California or by rioters or agent provocateur or a mix of the both, in city to shining, burning city. This is a country which is summed up by the contest Joe Biden versus Donald Trump. This is a country that doesn't actually know if this November's election not only can be trusted, but will not lead to a civil war, will not lead to the crowd of MAGA supporters on the White House lawn being cut down by the US Marines. This catastrophe of the neoliberal blonde-headed leader scenario is facing both of our countries, Britain and the United States, and in the very, very near future. London might be locked down next week. I might be forbidden by law to come to work. Don't worry about that. We'll find a solution if that were to happen. But the point I'm making is these grave existential challenges are taking place when both of our countries are led by idiots. Chamberlain was a disgrace. An appeaser. He was a total miserable failure. But I suspect he was not an idiot. We are led by idiots. And there's no Churchill waiting in the wings in either country. Think about that. I do. I think about it all the time. And lastly, we're going to be talking about cryptocurrency. Now, Max Kaiser is a big friend of mine, so you'd think I'd know everything about cryptocurrency. But actually, everything Max ever told me about it went right over my head. Maybe it did yours also, although Max is on three times a week and has a very big and loyal audience. I'll be talking to an old friend of mine, David Lowe, in Glasgow, who runs a Scottish Bitcoin outfit. We'll talk about that. And he has the view that this could be the answer to a separatist Scotland currency dilemma, whereby the best they can hope for, it seems, is to be like Panama, using American dollars, whilst not controlling them and certainly not being able to print them. All of that is coming up over the next 3 hours. We'll be talking to the absolutely inimitable Garland Nixon in just a few minutes about all things Americana. But I chose this poll that's out now because I could not believe my eyes last night when the BBC led with the news that a judge that I had never heard of in the United States of America had passed away at the age of 87. In the midst of this economic and public health crisis in Britain, the BBC chose to lead with the death of a woman aged 87 who was a judge, apparently, in a court in America. And so we're asking, why was the death of an American judge a leading item on the BBC? Is it A, she was a liberal, B, to damage Trump, or C, because we have become the 51st state of the United States of America? It's all coming up. Get voting now on my Twitter feed at George Galloway. And share if you're watching right now, please. I like it up here as the host of the biggest show on the planet. Now, the poll is going well, too. Why was the death of an American judge a leading item on BBC? A, she was a liberal, 22%. B, to damage Trump, 43%. C, because we have become the 51st state of the union, 35%. But in response on social media, Alex says, because the BBC is obsessed with Trump's America. As does Lewis. He says the BBC have always been obsessed with all things American. Well, let's see. I'm obsessed with Garland Nixon's take on the US election and the ongoing civil strife in his country. And he joins me now, my old colleague and friend. Garland, thank you very much indeed for rejoining us. We had a great conversation a few weeks ago, but things move on fast. The coronavirus is still cutting a swathe through your people. The economic crisis is even graver in your country than mine. But hey, we've both got a blonde-headed idiot as a leader. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, let me start by correcting you that the UK or the England certainly isn't the 51st state, because states have reciprocal agreements for extradition here. So if that were the case, if we were asking you
Julian
to send over Julian Assange,
yeah,
which we shouldn't be, then certainly Harry Brown's killer would be headed back. So I don't know. Maybe you guys are a colony. You certainly don't have the rights that another state would have.
That's a very sobering observation. Maybe I should amend that poll, because we have become a colony of our former colony. Garland, let's talk the economy first. I'm fascinated by this evictions crisis. Basically, your people have not been paying their rent or their mortgage. The landlords and the mortgage holders, the mortgage lenders, have not been able to enforce eviction on people until now. Now the landlords and the mortgage lenders have to do so because they are in hock to the banks with loans that they cannot pay. And the banks are foreclosing on the landlords, and the landlords are foreclosing on the tenants. And soon we'll be back in the 1930s in Hooverville, in tent cities.
Well, you know, the difference is in the 1930s, there weren't military-grade arms spread all throughout the nation like they are now. You know, there are now. You know, people had maybe shotguns and guns for shooting varmints with on their farms. Or now they've got, military-grade weapons everywhere. And what we're looking at is the dominoes that are falling for a failed state. On one end, the economic end of it, you have the landlords that can't pay the banks, and the properties go in default. And then, of course, needless to say, the banks start running into trouble. Well, we already know they're okay because the government's going to bail them out. But on the other side, we're looking at probably, I've heard numbers, 27 to 30 million families or tenants being thrown out. You add in the kids, you add in the extra people, and you probably have, what, 13, 14% of an entire nation being homeless? Think about that. You cannot have a civilized and structured society if 12 or 13% of the people are wandering aimlessly around looking for food and things of that nature. And let me add this. People are not going to sit around and be hungry and starve. They will take some kind of extra legal action, shall we say, be it breaking into stores or whatever. So we're moving in a direction. We're not a failed state yet. But if our leaders, and I use that word guardedly, if our leaders do not take the correct action, which they seem incapable of both politically and morally now, we're looking at a failed state physically where you're going to have, you know, it's going to look like a Dawn of the Dead movie.
Yes, but that's a very interesting point, because largely, not as much as we were led to believe, but largely the 1930s depression was endured by the poor. They had no weapons. They were beaten, browbeaten. But that's not going to happen again. The people will not go quietly into that good night of hunger and homelessness.
Well, the other part of it is this. In the 1930s, I believe about 60% of or higher of the U.S. were still living in an agrarian society. So there were a lot of people that were already poor. One of the a big part of the New Deal was bringing modern amenities to some of the rural areas, people bringing people water and electricity and things of that nature. So they didn't have the things to miss that they have now. And believe it or not, if you talk to older people in the Black community, basically who talk about their parents or grandparents during that time, what they'll say is most people in the Black community didn't even know there was a depression because they were so poor, they were already living like there was a depression in America because we had apartheid. Now, what we have is people who are used, who are accustomed to a fairly high standard of living, and they are not going to be happy. I suspect that let me add this, and we're moving into winter. If you've ever been to Chicago or Detroit, you are not going to survive in the open during the wintertime. So we're looking at not just, this is not just a political issue. This is not just a financial issue. It's going to become a physical issue where we have to deal with people who are on the streets, who are angry, who are hungry, and who are armed in many, many instances. And I think we all know that's not going to turn out well.
Wow. Now, in the midst of all of this, we've got a contest between a man who is barely alive, standing for the Democrats, and a man who is barely sane, standing for the Republicans, and nobody else. Nobody else can even get on the ballot. Not Jesse Ventura, who might be here and there, not the Green Party, who might be here or there. But in any case, they're not in the debates. They're not in the national argument. What do people do when faced with two cheeks of the same backside? Like that, especially a backside as, well, unprepossessing as this one.
Well, and the sad part about it is, you know, the working class, the working poor, the poor have a discussion about what our options are. But basically what we're looking at is we're looking at a battle between two factions of the ruling elite. And they've already both won. As far as the Democratic Party is, you know, as far as their perspective of beating Trump, they say they want to beat Trump. But if their main priority was to beat Trump, really? You're running Joe Biden, and you're going to convince me that your top priority is to beat Donald Trump? I don't think so. They've already accomplished their top priority, which was to beat Bernie Sanders. That's all that mattered. If Trump wins, they can still raise money. They still have their institution. They still have their power. And let's not forget that many of the funders, many of the powerful people that support the Democratic Party made it painfully clear that if Bernie Sanders were the nominee, that they were going to jump over and vote for Trump. So the reality is the people who always win have already won, and they're playing us around the edges to see. You know, this is about when the Democratic Party and the Republican Party is going after $1 million of money for their campaigns. Which one gets the $350 and which one gets $650? Who gets the bigger bite of the pie? If you've got the president, if your party has the presidency, you get the bigger bite of the pie. It's the same donors, and they're playing the same game. So we're kind of caught at the bottom. Therefore, most Americans, I don't think there's going to, well, I'll put it like this. People who are paying attention do not expect a dramatic change in the event. And I would even argue this, in the unlikely event that Joe Biden wins, because let's not forget, and this is critical, Joe Biden has to get through at least one debate. I don't know how Joe Biden gets through a debate. First of all, I don't know how he gets through the average day, but to get through a debate, I don't see that happening.
And of course, his running mate is now describing the ticket as Harris Biden rather than Biden Harris.
Well, you know, and I think she's probably of that entire group over there. She's probably the most honest one. I don't think anyone believes that Joe Biden is competent at this point to run, you know, a fast food restaurant, much less the United States of America. The fact of the matter is that, in my opinion, they are exactly the same. She's a person with no history of, you know, running, of being a governor, of running anything major. She was an AG, yes, but that's a different animal. But the fact of the matter is this. Both of those people are conduits for power. I don't think anyone who understands politics looks at them and thinks that they have an agenda that's going to be enacted over the next 4 to 8 years. There is an agenda that will be enacted through them. They are a conduit for the people who want to get some things done. So Biden, Harris, whatever, call it whatever you want to, but it's going to be the same neoliberal, neoconservative policies that gave us Trump. And most likely, if they win, it will get a worse Trump next time.
Will they win?
At this point, I'm going to say no, simply because I'm thinking, you know, when it comes down to it, I'm looking at the debates, and I say, I just think Joe Biden crashes and burns in the debates. Unless I'm wrong, unless a lot of people are wrong, this guy is not cognitively competent to stand up against Donald Trump. And let's not forget, when he went against Bernie Sanders, Bernie Sanders wouldn't take a bite out of his hide. Bernie Sanders kept, you know, calling off the dogs. And when he stumbles in a debate against Donald Trump, Donald Trump will tear him limb from limb. I think we already know that. Donald Trump loves to get down in the dirt and attack you and fight in the mud. Joe Biden, I just don't think he's going to be capable. There was a time in his life when he was. This ain't it. And after the debate, I think there's going to be an entirely different conversation about this. If he's not wise enough, and I'm going to say this, if the Democrats aren't smart enough to back out of the debate, they'd be far better off to take the heat for not going to debate than they would to put this guy out there and have him, you know, do a mushroom cloud in front of the entire world.
Talking of mushroom clouds, I'll tell you what is keeping me awake now at nights. The intensification of the Trump administration's war of words and war of sanction and trade measures escalating on the China front to the point of conflict.
You might think
that alarmist, but this week, China was flying over Taiwan, firing missiles and bombs over Taiwan into the sea because the United States had broken decades of policy by breaking the One China policy, by sending high-level officials to meetings in Taiwan that were absolutely determined as a provocation to China. And I'm beginning to worry that China's running out of patience with all of this. Tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock. And Trump might regard a war with China, a limited war with China, he would hope, might be an election winner for him.
Yeah, and you are, you know, you are wise in your concern here. And think about this. You know, for many years, a lot of developed nations have talked about Pakistan and said if the Pakistani government were eventually to fall, there are a lot of, you know, very nefarious groups behind, you know, in the shadows that a lot of, you know, responsible countries would have to go in and secure their nukes, right? Well, that's kind of us right now. The United States government, one could argue, has fallen to some extremist, you know, extremist neoconservative and neoliberal groups, and we got nukes. We are a very dangerous country right now, a country that is basically falling apart. We have a government that is pretending like everything's okay. They're walking around. Again, we're talking about upwards of 13% of the entire nation facing homelessness. We're talking about hunger. People, you can go on TV here in America and you can see people who are going from a food bank to food bank each day just to get something to eat. America's turning into a third world country, but a third world country with nukes. And it is, we are very, very dangerous situation. And I'll add this. You know, it was projected that somewhere around 2030 that China's economy would pass the U.S. as the number one economy in the world, right? But if you look at what's happening now, our response to the pandemic has pretty much wiped out our economy. You can change 2030 to, I don't know, I'm thinking 2021, because theirs is seems to be getting healthier, and our economy is, to say it's in the toilet would be, you know, would be giving it the benefit of the doubt. You can't have a decent economy when you don't even have a government capable of putting on an election in what is ostensibly a democratic republic.
Garland Nixon, I'd say it was a pleasure. It is a pleasure to see you again, but it's also quite chilling, if you get my drift. Thanks for joining us on the
Thank
Mother
you.
Of All Talk Shows. There's an American call right now on that subject. Let's take it, please. Chris, let's go to Michael in Minneapolis. Go ahead, Michael.
Hey, George, how are you doing today?
Always a pleasure to hear you. Go ahead.
All right, well, I was calling in. I want a quick comment just briefly on what you said about the Green Party, and it's even worse than you think. Recently, the Democrats worked and got the Green Party stricken off the ballot in three states, including swing states, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. So you won't even have the option of voting Green in those states.
Yeah.
But what I'm calling about was to talk about Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, whom obviously, you know, you had said you are not familiar with, so I thought it was worth bringing up. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is a very polarizing but important figure. She's essentially she was the vanguard of gender discrimination law in the United States. So she managed to make a lot of equality cases that previously had not applied to women were applied. So, you know, the things like women were able now to sign a mortgage without a man, have a bank account without a male cosigner, have a job without being discriminated against by gender.
Why is all that left to judges, Michael? You see, here, we don't even know the names of our judges. I could not name for you, well, but one, the Julian Assange's judge. I don't know the names of any judges in Britain. Is it a healthy sign of your democracy that these fundamentals that you have described can be attributed to a judge?
No, but George, I think what it highlights is that the judiciary in the United States is a fully political entity. And the right wing of the United States has been, you know, there's been a full-out war on women, you know, at least as long as I've been alive and far longer. So the reason why people are so scared is because the liberals were already in a 5-4 minority on the Supreme Court. And now with RBG gone and Justice Roberts is very conservative, but in our right wing America, he's the quote unquote swing vote. And he usually goes along with prior precedent, although he is very right wing whenever he has the opportunity to be. So the fear is that with RBG gone, you get another conservative justice in, and all of a sudden they don't need Roberts as much to, you know, to sort of change the laws and to, you know, and the right wing in the United States is always trying to take away reproductive rights from women. That's been a consistent fight ever since Roe v. Wade in the 70s. And they're, you know, the states in certain conservative states, they're always passing legislation to try to restrict abortion rights and restrict other healthcare rights for women. But the reason why this is really interesting in election year is because in 2016, Justice Antonin Scalia died 237 days before Election Day, and Obama nominated Merrick Garland to replace him, and the Republican Senate said, no, we're not going to have a hearing. And instead of pushing for it, instead of using his bully pulpit, which he was never willing to do, and really, you know, really forcing the Republicans to make this an issue, privately behind the scenes, Obama said, hey, this isn't so bad because it will help get the base out to vote. So they sort of used the Supreme Court seat as a way to hopefully motivate Democratic voters. Of course, it had the opposite effect. And what it did was actually galvanize Trump's base. And here we are. So now we're in a situation where that was 237 days before the election, when Antonin Scalia died. Now we're only 46 days before the election, I think, when RBG died. And now the same Republicans who said, "Oh, it's got to be up to the American people. We can't have we can't do this during an election year," are saying, "Oh, we need to confirm someone immediately."
Michael, is that Donald Trump knows how to use the bully pulpit in a way that Barack Obama was not ready to. Thanks for the call. Garland Nixon was listening to that. Garland, I ask in a way the same question to you as I did to Michael. I don't know how liberal this woman was. From a personal point of view, I'm not sure what is progressive about abortion, for example. I know that people are going to have it, not trying to stop people having it, but I'm not sure why it's progressive. How liberal am I supposed to regard this woman? And why is a judge that important in your system? If all these things, abortion, gay rights, and so on, are so important, why doesn't the American government legislate for them? Why do they rely on a here today, gone tomorrow judge?
You make a good point, because within the context of the American system, most of the things that the Supreme Court rules on, generally our Congress, our legislative branch, can go back and tweak it, and they can fix it the way they want to. But unfortunately, they're generally unable to do this. But here's the thing about the concept of women's rights or LGBT rights. You know, I work on a lot of that stuff, and I mean in the interest of openness, I'm actually on the National Board of Directors for the American Civil Liberties Union. So we're always in, you know, Supreme Court for one reason or another. And what I've found is the LGBTQ rights and things of that nature, those rulings, to be quite honest, haven't changed much, even with some of these conservative judges. When it comes to the social issues, they haven't been really that much different in a way that would be markedly, you know, far right. What I see in American in our Supreme Court is they are there for corporate law. They are there to make the decisions when it comes to corporation. When it comes to the things about, you know, women, reproductive rights, et cetera, the conservatives have actually recently been very angry at their picks because, you know, let's face it, they're all the neoliberals, neoconservatives, so-called left, so-called right. When it comes to the social justice issues and the issues of LGBTQ, et cetera, they're not that far different. They are there, though, to deal with corporate issues and to transfer full power to the corporate oligarchs, and they are really good at that.
Garland, thanks, and I really appreciate you sticking around to respond to that call. Well, it's just as well Motes has got its own money man now, David Lowe, an old friend of mine, haven't seen him for many years, but the man that masterminded the takeover of Celtic and its move from, well, the old world into the new. I think he's got a new book out, actually, about that. We'll ask him about that. But it's just as well, David Lowe, I hope he will agree to be our money man, because I've now got breaking news from the BBC. HSBC moved Ponzi scheme millions despite warning. This is from Panorama. HSBC, that's one of the world's biggest banks, allowed fraudsters to transfer millions of dollars around the world, even after it had learned of their scam. Leaked secret files show. Britain's biggest bank, moved the money through its US business to HSBC accounts in Hong Kong, in 2013, 2014. Its role in the $80 million fraud is detailed in a leak of documents that have been called the FinCEN files. David Lowe, welcome to the show. It's been some, well, the best part of 20 years. Very good to see you again. You came on to talk about cryptocurrency, and we will, but have you got a response to this leaked BBC material?
Well, George, I just heard about it literally 10 minutes ago when I was speaking to your researcher, so I don't have any details of what's come out vis-a-vis HSBC. But I think we all know money laundering and banks has been going on for as long as there has been money and there have been banks. So it's just very infrequently that they get caught in such a large way. But it is as old as the hills, and I can't say I'm that surprised. But details I do not have. I cannot comment beyond that.
Does cryptocurrency deepen that potential problem or alleviate it?
When you have value, when you have money, and when you have greed, there is always fraud. Again, that's as old as the hills. Traditionalists, bankers, governments, those that seek to regulate us, will always plow the furrow that cryptocurrency is a means of anonymously and fraudulently transferring money. That's not the case. It's a convenient banner, a convenient headline to use, but it's certainly not the case. Most transactions, by a significant margin, still go through the traditional banking system, and that's where all the fraud lies and where all the theft lies, quite frankly.
Yes, so, but on the face of it, I mean, neither of us knows the criminal mind, but if I was a criminal, I'd want to have my money in cryptocurrency rather than in the Bank of Scotland in Byres Road, wouldn't you?
I suppose you could say that. If you wanted to transfer a lot of money anonymously, you would maybe look at cryptocurrency as a means of doing that. But cryptocurrencies are becoming more and more regulated, and practitioners in the industry have to be verified by the traditional setups, the traditional governments. It's no longer the Wild West that it was a mere 5 years ago. You can't really get involved in this space in a significant way without the people you're dealing with knowing who you are, where you live, where you stay, and you have to provide documentation. So as each year goes by, it is conforming more and more with what we're familiar with in terms of regulation.
Well, let's go back to first base. I'm a very good friend of Max Keiser, who might be called the cryptocurrency king. He was certainly one of the very first off the rank on it. And he's spoken to me about it so many times. But I've got to tell you, David, almost all of it went right over my head. Why don't you give us an idiot's guide to what cryptocurrency is?
Well, cryptocurrency is just a series of codes that operate on what everybody is familiar with, a thing called the blockchain, which is just a euphemistic term for a distributed ledger technology, whereby the assets, which is basically the pieces of code, are owned by the people that operate the ledger, the distributed ledger, and they get paid, or the phrase used is they mine and they get paid in Bitcoin, which is the first and the largest cryptocurrency for performing that task. So a distributed ledger comes with a distributed cost, and that cost goes to the miners that maintain, in this instance, which I'm talking about, the Bitcoin blockchain.
Now, what do they mean by miner? I've always been puzzled by this phrase. I have some experience of mining, but we're not talking about people down below with a pickaxe hacking away at a wall. What do they mean by mining?
They get paid in Bitcoin for performing a duty or a function that helps to maintain the integrity of the blockchain, the distributed ledger. It's a means of payment for performing a duty. If you want you to dig or drill or mine deeper and deeper, you really have to speak to a technology professional, but it would go beyond the comprehension of most of the listeners, I would suggest.
Yeah, there's a danger of that. Let's say I get paid tonight in Bitcoin. What does that mean? Do I get a bit of a coin, or do I get an email saying you're now the proud owner of X as your payment for tonight's show? And if so, how do I spend it?
Well, think of it just as like an online banking account. If you wanted to get paid in Bitcoin, you would have to have what's called a wallet. And the person that was paying you would send you a specified number of Bitcoins, or it could be a fraction of a Bitcoin. One Bitcoin is worth approximately $10,000 or $11,000 at the moment.
Well, it'll definitely be a fraction, David. Definitely be a fraction.
Well, maybe a big fraction. I don't know. If it was half a Bitcoin, if it was $5,000, for example, the person that was paying you would send you half a Bitcoin from their wallet to your wallet, and you would look at your wallet in the same way as you would look at an online banking account, and you would see a credit of half a Bitcoin to your account. And a Bitcoin is just like another currency, like a pound, a dollar, a euro. You could transform that into dollars for value, or sterling, or euros. It goes from one wallet to another, is the answer to your question, and you see it as a balance in your wallet.
But I could spend it, I think, in your place in Glasgow, because you take Bitcoins. But I don't know any other shops or restaurants that would take my Bitcoin.
Well, there's over 5,000 cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin is what you would call the first. Bitcoin is what you would call the largest in terms of market value. Last time I looked, it had a market value of about $200 billion, and that represented two-thirds of the total market capitalization of all the cryptocurrencies put together. But what is happening with Bitcoin? Bitcoin is emerging more, George, as a store of value, much the same as gold is, an alternative investment, an alternative store of value in these troubled times. More and more people are becoming more and more worried about, as you know, the world we live in, the people that are running the world we live in, the veracity and integrity of the existing banking and saving systems and stock markets. So for more and more people, Bitcoin represents what you would call an alternative investment. And that basically means they're buying Bitcoin because they think it's going to go up in value. It's a store of value. So that's really the primary role that Bitcoin is playing as it evolves.
Now, tell us about your Mac Bitcoin.
Mac Bitcoin, that would be the Scott coin. So, I mean, you'll probably like this. I mean, I'm an investment guy, as you know, private equity investor. I was sitting watching Alistair Darling debate with Alex Salmond in 2014. Over the currency for Scotland, should it be independent, and whether Alex had a plan B. And of course, I don't know if you remember that debate.
I do, yeah, of course, never forget.
I'll use my own language. I thought, and I'm not being political in saying that, I thought Darling sliced and diced Alex Salmond because he didn't have a plan B. And the most important thing that an independent country must have wishes to pay its ways a currency. And I thought, if Scotland doesn't have its own currency, I think this whole independence thing is pretty much a waste of time. And in saying that, I have to keep emphasizing I'm being apolitical. I'm also being very logical. So I thought, they're going to lose the referendum. Currency is not a devolved power. So what can you have? You can have a cryptocurrency, a Scottish cryptocurrency. So I looked about and I found that one already existed. The guy that founded it, a guy called Derek Nisbet, was a one-man band of a fashion, and he wanted to sell it. So I bought the IP myself and a business partner and paid for it in Bitcoin, I might add, at a fraction of the price that it's at just now. And then we wondered what we were going to do with it. and we've had it ever since. But it caught the upswing in value. Bitcoin went pretty ballistic, and all the other cryptocurrencies did as well over the next few years. And Scottcoin actually emerged as a global top 100 cryptocurrency, which is maintained because it's worth $140 million. And out of the 5,000 cryptos that I've already referred to, it's in the top 100. So it's no little sideshow, George. It's quite a big deal.
So how much does it cost me to buy one of your Scottcoins?
Well, roughly, if you want to express it in sterling terms, because we're in the UK, one Scottcoin is worth approximately 12 pence at the moment. And when you extrapolate that's out to the coins in issue, that's where the $140 million value comes. But one Scottcoin is worth approximately 12 pence.
Well, consider one sold, David, if you'll sell me one. And are you projecting this into the independence debate? And if so, is it falling on stony ground?
Well, we have had some discussions with civil servants representing the Scottish government. But as you know, governments around the world just now are preoccupied with immediate priorities and accept and recognise that something is far out for as cryptocurrencies is a bit too much for the Scottish government to deal with just now. But certainly I think Scottcoin has a role to play in either a devolved or an independent Scotland. Cryptocurrencies are here to stay. They're only going one way, and that's upwards as more and more people understand how they work. You've got to remember, George, younger people are more tech savvy than people of our age.
Yes, well, that wouldn't be hard in my case. Now, you'll always be Mr. Celtic to me. Did I understand correctly that you've got a book about the takeover?
No, I did bring out a book at the time, but what's happening is on its fifth day reprint just now, because a sort of younger generation are looking back 25 years and increasingly asking, you know, who was this guy McCann? What was all this about? You know, I can hardly believe it's more than 25 years ago.
Well, I can't believe it. It's just knocked me out.
Sorry?
I can't believe it. I had no idea it was 25 years. Amazing.
Yeah, more than that, in fact. But so it's getting reprinted, and there's interest in turning it into a movie. I have no idea who'll play me.
It'd be a great movie. What's the book called, David?
Well, the book's called The McCann Takeover, but it was originally called The Rebels in Paradise. And you can buy it on Amazon or directly from the publisher, which is me.
Fantastic. David Lowe, the new Moats Money Man, thanks very much indeed. What was the why was the death of an American judge a leading item on BBC? A, she was a liberal, 21%. B, to damage Trump, 40%. C, because we have become the 51st state of the Union. That's at 39%. So either to damage Trump, or because we are the 51st state, or maybe, actually, all three. Anyway, you can vote until 10 minutes to 9 on my Twitter feed, at George Galloway. Now, it was another week of persecution, veering between tragedy and farce, and back again to tragedy in the Old Bailey this week in the persecution of Julian Assange. Pablo Navarrete has made a cracking film about this, and he joins me now. Pablo, thank you for joining us. We'll talk about your documentary in a minute. But how did the week go for Julian? From my standpoint, his defense team is winning every argument out of the park. Question is, does that matter?
Unfortunately, it probably might not matter, and that speaks to the absolute travesty of the British judicial system, and specifically in relation to the process around Julian Assange. I mean, there has been a litany of articles now showing the irregularities in how this case has been processed from the very beginning, even with, you know, with the Keir Starmer, when he was head of CPS, intervening with the Swedish prosecutors who wanted to speak to Julian initially over these sexual assault allegations, to the judges presiding over the case, their links to conservative, or in some instances, their merit to former conservative defense ministers, links to the security services. But yes, I think this, I've heard the same. I've heard that the defense has been winning, hands down, and that this really should really mean, in any fair system of justice, that the judge would not allow the U.S. Extradition request and allow Julian Assange to go to the U.S., where he faces 175 years in prison, further prison, for exposing U.S. war crimes. However, this judge has a 95% rate of extraditing people. And as I said, the British justice system has covered itself ingloriously with this case. So let's wait and see. But it's been a good week.
I'd be amazed. She might be fooling us all, but she has favored the Americans at every turn, on every point, from the regime that Julian is enduring, to the conduct of the case in court, the potential offences of distortion of the process, abuse of process are legion now, and they may all have to be explored in an appeal, which, of course, if she finds in favour of the US, there will be, and maybe a better judge, maybe a judge that cares more about justice will be found on the appeal court. But she could be, I suppose, the greatest actress since Garbo, and giving us all these dashed hopes only in order to turn the tables. That's a possibility. The defence team produced some pretty spectacular witnesses in the week, including the legendary 89-year-old Daniel Ellsberg, the man who leaked the Pentagon Papers, which changed the course of American history, political and legal history, who's still alive and who was on, I think, 2 o'clock in the morning his time, or 3 o'clock in the morning at his time, by video link to the court. And he was unequivocal, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just Daniel Ellsberg, but he joins, I mean, a legend such as Daniel Ellsberg has joined what now is an increasing chorus of real journalists, I'd say, because there are those that call themselves journalists who have really joined in the persecution, who have been kind of almost the vanguard of this smearing of Julian Assange, of the people, journalists, a notable amount of them at the Guardian newspaper, who have been, you know, initially sort of benefiting from all of this courageous journalism that Julian Assange has exposed and done, but now we're very much at the vanguard of smearing him, of setting the ground for public opinion to not really care sufficiently that a journalist is being is a political prisoner in the UK. But we have real journalists like John Pilger, real journalists like Daniel Ellsberg, even real journalists like Mohamed Elmazi, who appears in my film, someone who's just been reporting the truth around this case very meticulously from the very beginning. And I think anyone who reports honestly about the case will report that this is a massive political persecution of a journalist for exposing war crimes. And what the US is trying to do is to send a very chilling message to anyone, almost like a mafia leaving the head of a dead horse in someone's bed, sort of saying, you know, you mess with us and we will destroy you. And so I think that true journalists know what's at stake. Real groups of freedom of expression know what is at stake. And I think in as far as the truth can come out, I think public opinion can maybe help turn this and put political pressure on the British to not acquiesce in becoming the 51st state of the US, as you mentioned, if we're not that already.
And of course, Peter Hitchens, a right-wing conservative journalist, very powerfully coming out for Julian Assange this week, and the wonderful court reporting from the Honourable Craig Murray, former British ambassador. One does sense a certain change. The issue is whether or not it's too late. Now, tell us about your film, Pablo, and how people can see it.
So my film is a 35-minute short documentary that follows Julian's father, John Shipton, who's been travelling to and from Australia here to visit Julian to help, to be part of this global grassroots campaign to prevent Julian from essentially being killed in a US prison. He's already suffered, as we know, as a de facto prisoner in the Ecuadorian embassy, given that the UK did not allow him a safe passage to Ecuador after he was given political asylum. And this film just follows Julian's father at a number of solidarity events in the UK, but also it tries to humanize the story of a father essentially trying to save his son's life. But it also tries to offer this other side, which is to show this group of sort of very dedicated, small but very dedicated grassroots activists who have, come rain or shine, been outside Belmarsh Prison, outside the Ecuadorian embassy, outside the Westminster Magistrates Court, who have been shunned, ignored by the media, denigrated or laughed at, and who know what's at stake. They know that this is one of the greatest injustices of our time. So the film just tries to show both of those sides of a story in a 35-minute film, and you can see it. It will be actually on Vimeo on demand as of early this week. We've done a number of online screenings. We've done a screening in Spanish, in French, in Brussels on Monday. There will be other screenings in different languages, but it will be available to stream on demand this week.
And it's called what, Pablo?
It's called No Extradition, which is a simple title, and it's the title that was on the placards that I would see at Belmarsh, at the Magistrates' Court, and it basically encapsulates really what the call is, what the demand is, and what really should happen if there was any justice with Julian Assange.
I hope everyone watches it. Pablo Navarrete, thanks for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows. On Facebook, Tom says, Sleepy Joe will not turn up for his debates with Trump. They'll make an excuse for him. And Michaela says, Trump has nothing to worry about. He has walked this. And Gareth says, I never knew Garland Nixon. He's great. Thanks for having him on. Great indeed he is. And on Twitter, Roger says, you can't pay tax on cryptocurrency. It's specifically for tax dodging payments anyway. You can't buy bonds with it. It's a game running alongside a real economy. Nothing more than an elaborate PayPal. Jason, though, says only in a few places is Bitcoin legal tender for tax. I've been involved for several years. It's here to stay, says Jason, and it will soon replace gold as the chosen secure long-term investment. That's why I'm buying 12 pence worth of Scotcoin instead of buying gold. I did start off by saying, and you'll have seen that I won't be in this studio with anyone else without my mask on. I've got it off now because I'm alone in the studio. Ranjit Brar, doctor, physician, surgeon, has helped us through this crisis, and we're sticking with him. But he must be getting anxious as these numbers begin to mount. Let's see if I'm right. Dr. Ranjit, thank you again for joining us. Numbers are pretty bleak, aren't they?
George, good to be back with you. Yes, George, there's no question that the much-feared second wave essentially is upon us, and upon us across Europe, probably. As we saw Italy showing, being ahead of us by about 3 weeks in the February, March, April period, we can probably see that Spain is about 6 weeks ahead of us and France about 3 weeks ahead of us. But we are very much following the trajectory of their rise in numbers of infections. Yesterday we had test proven 4,500 infections. It seems likely now that there are 70,000 or 80,000 people who currently are infected in Britain. Those rates have doubled over the period of a week, and that's seen in a lot of other indices as well. So the rates of hospitalization are starting to increase. Our rates of hospitalization, again, essentially doubled. Our death rates have essentially doubled. They were, for 3 or 4 weeks, they've been quite low over the last part of the summer. They were actually, if you total them up and look back in retrospect, there were probably no days when there were zero deaths. And the weekly average was running between 50 and 70. That doubled over the last week. And sadly, we've had 136 people who have died of coronavirus over the last week. So all of these numbers are doubling. And probably we're having, as I say, 4,500 cases a day. But it's the rate of increase that is most worrying. And there's kind of many sources and many data measures are showing essentially that within a couple of weeks' time, we could be back into a similar situation as in March on a exponentially rising number of cases, George.
Now, the evidence that I have seen from Europe, which, as you say, is ahead of us as they were in the beginning, it hit there before it hit here. More fool us for not taking the breathing space that we were thus offered to get ourselves in better shape to deal with this. But there's some evidence, isn't there, that though cases are rising rapidly on the European continent, that death rates are not following them. There is some evidence, therefore, that this second wave is less fatal, less deadly than the first wave. We must hope and pray that that is true, of course. First of all, is it, in your view, likely to be true? And secondly, what if it isn't? What if we are back to 1,000 people a day dying of coronavirus? How are we going to cope with that?
I think those are both reasonable questions, George. And as I was saying, I don't think there's a fundamental difference between the virus, but I think that the way that our countries have reorganized to cope with the virus has changed significantly. Obviously, the first time round, we had virtually no ability to test, and that had to be ramped up from zero all over the place. Some countries did that very effectively, some very poorly. It's true that the most vulnerable section of the society has caught the virus, and so we're likely to have slightly more resilient population overall. However, there are still very many millions who have not had the virus who are susceptible. So there's certainly, this pandemic has a long way to run if left unchecked. Of course, it's not being totally left unchecked. We do have tracing, we do have tracking, and other countries have shown it's possible both to, get on top of the first wave and get on top of the second wave, the ones who did it very successfully the first time round. We've talked about before, the Korean Peninsula did extremely well, China did extremely well, other countries like New Zealand did extremely well. China essentially eradicated the virus and has returned to normal and shows no sign of an appreciable second wave, having had a high level of vigilance through very good, well-coordinated public testing measures and social isolation. On this second wave, countries like Japan, Germany, again, South Korea, have done well at essentially getting on top of the virus early and therefore minimizing its impact on us all. Unfortunately, all the evidence so far is that our testing and tracing program remains very poor. The numbers are much higher, but the numbers of people who are tested is about half the number of tests performed.
And so some people are getting two tests.
Yeah, that's right. They're double counting in many respects. Sometimes a swab still being taken from the nose and the mouth and be counted as two tests. So all of these things can confound the numbers slightly. Equally, in particular, our tracing system we've talked about many times. Dido Harding, who is a former chief executive of TalkTalk Group, a dame and very connected to our current administration and is a very establishment figure, has been put in charge of this without any appreciable acumen in this department or any particular qualifications. All of the money which is being pumped into this, increasing amount of money which is being pumped into this field, is not being run via the NHS. It's not the NHS capacity, which has been expanded to deal with all of these medical problems. Rather, the axe has continued to be wielded on the NHS, and all of this money is being pushed privately into Group 4 Securities, Serco, the Big Four marketing accountancy groups, all of these and other private providers. The Lighthouse Laboratory is famously for the testing in their very large centres. So it's not the local expertise of the National Health Service which is being increased in capacity and increased in funding. Rather, it continues to be starved of resources. More and more money is going into a private sector who are not performing adequately. And we know that probably only a fifth of the people who are being contacted, perhaps half of the people who have a positive test, half of those contacts are traced. And we know of those half who are traced, only a fifth are actually self-isolating, largely because many of them are unable economically to stop.
Well, that brings me on to, in a way, my main question to you now. According to Boris Johnson, people who are told to self-isolate are going to be fined up to £10,000 if they don't do it. First of all, how are we going to know that they didn't do it? Who's in charge of finding out that they didn't do it? And is £10,000 a realistic amount of money to fine someone who's broken their quarantine because they desperately had to go to work because they can't live on the current stipend that they have?
Well, I think all of those points are absolutely spot on. No one is going to be able to find the vast majority of people who are unable to self-isolate. There's no social provision, there's no monetary provision, there's no place that is given to them where they can isolate from society. That was why, I hate to say the same thing again and again, that was why China was able to eradicate the virus after about 80,000 cases, and they had less than half of 100th of 1% of their population have had the virus, because they provided social support, they provided social isolation from where social place where the population who were positive could isolate. From there, they could be nursed back to health and after several tests discharged back into the community, or if they deteriorated, could rapidly access good, you know, gold standard healthcare, including ventilation or whatever medications are available. So those measures are not in place. We've given huge amounts of money to a private sector who are unable to carry on with their normal private practice, just essentially to keep their doors open without them providing any service. We haven't used even those private hospitals to put people who, for example, have tested positive and need isolation in a place where they can get adequate medical and social care. So no, they won't be able to do so. The concept that now an app will be launched and that everyone will get on it, if their reward is going to be a £10,000 fine when they're unable to follow the advice because there's no actual provision made for them, you can see why these measures are as ineffective in our society and why British and American society, the laissez-faire free market fundamentalist economic model, generating so much wealth from so much of the world, having taken money hand over fist from so much of the world, is still able to unable to provide for such a large proportion of our own populations, and why the indices of social deprivation in our countries are spiralling out of control now, George.
Lastly, and I'm grateful for your time as always, where do we stand on vaccine? Am I right in assuming that we will not be buying the Russian vaccine, even though it is, on the face of it, a success story? Many other countries are asking for it and being given it. I'm presuming we won't, because Britain hates Russia and America hates Russia and America hates China. They hate both. So do we. Our own, I say our own loosely, it'll be owned by a multinational drug company. Our own vaccine, when is it happening?
Very good questions, George. Of course, I'm sure you don't hate the Russian or Chinese people. On the contrary, have a greater admiration and respect. You could even say love of the great things that these nations, as other nations, have given to the world. And I'm sure even our own government wouldn't put it crudely in that way. But essentially, you're right. They have a deep enmity and geopolitical rivalry. Both the British government and the American government is dominating the American election, whether they emphasize, you know, when Trump was asked questions recently about Russian interference, he even said, you know, it's China you've got to be worrying about at the moment. So they're conflicted themselves as to who is the biggest bogeyman, who is their biggest rival, whether they look militarily or economically. In terms of its being economic powerhouse, probably China, but in terms of its nuclear arsenal and military capability, it's Russia. And of course, the two are now very closely aligned in opposing the interventionism and aggressive nature of US and British military presence in their regions and in the world, and their economic strategy. So yes, I think it's highly unlikely that this vaccine, which has been shown to be safe, but as yet is basically going through an extended phase three trial of a large part of the population in Russia elsewhere, which has been essentially promised in millions and hundreds of millions of doses to different countries around the world. Our own country, which has bought up hundreds of millions of doses from very many companies, has shown no interest in acquiring that vaccine, though it is proved as efficacious and more efficacious than others, and has been the first to grant license. But people, you know, justly say it's been granted license during the period of its phase three trial. Essentially, it's showing excellent data. All the data that we have, and I've reviewed that paper in The Lancet, shows that it's extremely efficacious and safe. Of course, when you're giving something in hundreds of millions of doses, you need to have very robust safety data, because even a very small element of being unsafe can translate into disastrous consequences. So this is a reasonable criticism which is held up. However, it is unreasonable that there will be no interest shown in this vaccine, which so far has proven to be one of the amongst the best candidates in the world. And yes, it is being rolled out in Russia and other countries. The Chinese also have a vaccine which they're rolling out to certain groups, high-risk groups, and within their military, in their own country. And these are the front runners. So the front runners are from the geopolitical bloc, which is our rival, and it's unquestionably the case that we will be denied access to those, at least in the first instance. The main vaccines that we're backing are the GlaxoSmithKline Oxford vaccine, which was temporarily halted due to safety concerns, but it only lasted about a week, and has been that trial is ongoing. And America's so-called Warp Speed program from their major pharmaceutical company. So those vaccines trials are ongoing. Licenses are not expected to be granted this year.
It's going to be a long cold winter then for the coronavirus.
I think that's right. And I think we're essentially in the same situation where we are left with the tried and tested public health measures as our only measure to combat this. And it's failure to implement adequate health measures of our government and the United States government is what's leaving us in this ongoing situation. And I do understand there's a degree of skepticism, there's a degree of fatigue with this question, there's a degree of hostility to the government, which translates into a disbelief in the very existence of this virus. The virus is real, the threat is real. I'm afraid the curve is increasing and we are going to see a second wave. And what we should remember is it's the inadequacy of our government to institute adequate health measures, which is leaving us in the situation where possibly our liberties will be increasingly infringed. We know 13 million people are already under some form of partial lockdown, and it increasingly looks the case that it's being signalled that there'll be an increasing lockdown, perhaps over the half-term bank holiday. Certainly, we're expecting the peak of this by the end of October and November period, George.
Dr. Ranjit, thanks as always on the coronavirus. We never really get on to other health matters because of the gravity of the situation. Stuart in Rugeley wants to talk about China. I'm always up for that. Stuart, go ahead, sir.
Hello, George. Pleased to speak to you. I've always been a big admirer all day.
I'm not getting this loud and clear. Is everyone else?
Oh, sorry.
Go on, Stuart. That's better.
OK, sorry, yeah, sorry, I've always been a great admirer of yours, but I don't think you will be after what I've got to say. can I just say that we Brits actually don't hate China or Russia, but we do hate their governments.
Why do you hate them? What have they ever done to you, Stuart?
The Russian people haven't done anything to me. Now, they were absolutely sterling in the war, and we couldn't have won the war without them. But the thing is, what we do is we hate dictators.
Sorry?
We hate dictators like Putin.
Stuart, how is he a dictator?
He's a dictator because he's just manipulated the law so that he can be re-elected, in inverted commas.
But he'd only be re-elected if... But Stuart, I'll let you back in. I just want to point out a rather obvious flaw in what you're saying. He could only be re-elected if the majority of people voted for him. And if they voted for him, he wouldn't be a dictator.
Yes, and I appreciate the point, and you're absolutely right. However, he's manipulated the law so that he can have himself put in a place for re-election.
But Stuart, how long... But a British Prime Minister can be re-elected for 50 years, for the rest of their life, as long as they get re-elected.
No, George. His party can be re-elected on a manifesto. You can change prime ministers as many times as you like.
You can, and we badly need to do so now. My point to you, Stuart, is there are no term limits to how long you can be the Prime Minister of Britain. And there's certainly no time limits, as Her Majesty is proving, for how long you can be the head of state in Britain.
Yeah, but she was born into the job. That's the difference. She wasn't.
Stuart, you're not seriously saying she was born into the job. That's different.
Yeah, no, it is different. It is.
How is it different? How? I can't let you away. How is it different?
She had no choice. Putin manipulated.
We have no choice. We have no choice. She's the head of state, whether we like it or not. Putin is the elected president of Russia.
So yes, and he was, and he was elected. But the point is, they had a law that said you could only do so many terms, and he hit that.
And then they had a referendum. Well, because they had a referendum to scrap that. But the point I'm making to you, we don't have an elected head of state, and neither do we have term limits on how long you can be the prime minister for. So neither of those two complaints of yours make him a dictator.
Well, again, with his kleptocracy mates who...
That's a different matter. I'm against kleptocracy. There's quite a few kleptocrats just along the road from me here. You don't need to be a Russian to be a kleptocrat, Stuart.
I knew you were going to say that. I'm surprised you didn't say Boris and Cola. But as well, I'd like to mention...
I need to let you go now because of the hour. Stuart, tell me this. Where is Rugeley?
Rugeley is right in the middle of Staffordshire. It's about 8 miles from Cannock, Lichfield...
Excellent.
..and Stafford.
Excellent.
Right in the middle. We used to have a power station.
Yeah, good man. You've educated me tonight on that, at least. John is in Benidorm. Now, I'm not going to say I wish I was in Benidorm, because that would be untrue. But I'm very glad to hear from you.
Yeah, Benidorm's divided into two areas, the civilised area and the not-so-civilised area.
Now, tell me, is it the British that live in the civilised area?
No, I do, and quite a few British do, but it's mainly Spanish holiday flats, what they use for between 4 and 8 weeks a year, and they're empty for the rest of the year.
Now, you were poorly the last time I spoke to you. You were in the hospital. Are you better now?
Yeah, I had COVID, and then I had a double heart operation, which I got over, and I'm much better now. Thank you. Excellent.
Very glad to hear
it, John. First of all, I'd just like to comment on the health situation in Spain, because it's worse than England.
Yeah, it's ahead of us, two, three weeks maybe.
Yeah. At the end of July, the Spanish government made you wear masks everywhere, on the streets, on transport, in the shops. Everywhere you go, you've got to wear a mask. It doesn't matter where you are. And since they've done that, the Spanish COVID incidence have gone up the most in Europe.
So it hasn't, so that hasn't worked. The masks haven't worked in Spain.
It hasn't made any difference.
Now, that's very, very unfortunate.
Yeah, well, most of the Spanish people in Benidorm now have gone back to Madrid. Madrid has got the highest amount of infection in Europe, and they should be under lockdown. They're half under lockdown starting Monday, but if the figures don't improve, it'll be under complete lockdown, and the whole of Spain will be under lockdown before November.
Oh, dear, dear, dear. John, stay safe. I know that they've looked after you well there, but let's try and keep you out of hospital if we can. Rashid is in Long Beach. Now, there I'd like to be. He wants to talk about Donald Trump. Go ahead, Rashid.
Hey, George. I just wanted to bring the attention to your listeners about the revelations from a recent book by Bob Woodward about attempted soft coup by some of the generals, particularly Mr. Mad Dog Mattis, who was Secretary of Defense at the time.
Yeah. It turns out to be not so mad after all.
Well, it could be not so mad. Don't forget, that was the same gentleman who led the destruction of Fallujah.
Indeed.
Where he had no reluctance.
That was
no
rabid. That was rabid.
Yeah, no reluctance to tie civilians on tanks and personnel carriers to protect American troops.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of virtuous human being that is supposedly leading an
effort
internal
within the United
States. Why
does Trump keep appointing these types? First of all, they turn against him and are trying their best to destroy him. And secondly, they stand for the precise opposite of what he claimed in the election campaign himself to stand for.
Well, he's, I couldn't tell you the details because I'm not into that, but my speculation simply, he's such a total outsider. He assumed the Republican establishment represented Main Street when the Republican establishment represents Wall Street and the military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
And they're never going to let that cash cow go away. And to be promoted, whether you're in the military, whether you're in the judiciary, whether you're in the legislature, you have to join that team. Anybody who's not part of that team gets pushed out.
Yeah. So you've read the Woodward book. Were you impressed?
By Mr. Woodward's book?
Yeah.
Or by the attempt to... Mr. Woodward's an insider. His job is political smash-up. So as needed, he'll write dirt. As needed, he'll write something positive.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm grateful that these revelations on the internal machinations, the internal internecine warfare, is being spilled out because the public never sees this and never hears about it. And whether you're for Trump or against Trump, the fact that there's an internal attempt to ignore the actions of elected president should be questionable. I mean, I'm pretty long in the tooth, and I remember the way they came after Jimmy Carter, and I remember the way they came after Geoff Whitlam in Australia. Anybody who deviates from the program has to be smashed.
Yeah.
And someone may look like an insider, but if he's even one-tenth out of their frame of reference, he has to go.
Just in a sentence, Rashid, do you think Trump's going to be reelected?
George, when I would look back at 2016 and being participating in elections as an observer since 1976, the vote rigging on the state level, on the national level, is absurd. And in 2016, the Democratic Party, the U.S. establishment, thought Hillary had it in the bag. They took their foot off the accelerator. They're not going to let that happen again. But if you go to the general population outside of the East Coast and the West Coast, he still has considerable support. Now the question is, can the vote rigging overcome the considerable support? If it's close, they can steal it. But if it's massive, they have to do their work to hide it.
Rashid, thanks, as always, for the call. Last call, I suspect, is Lee in Grimsby, who has a theory for curing coronavirus. We better hear him. Go ahead, Lee.
Hello there. Yeah, you could call it a theory, I suppose. Well, I'll start with a rhetorical question, George. Do you know anybody that's never got a cold? Okay. Right. So the answer is no, which means that this is probably endemic, which we're facing. And therefore, the only way around this is we can't get a vaccine. Well, we've got a vaccine for the flu, but we all know that doesn't work. People still die from the flu. So
no, it does work. It protects a large number of people from the flu.
It protects to an extent. Okay, I'll give you that. Mm. But people still die of the flu, okay?
Sure.
So we've got to look at ways to get around this. And a study came out. There's been a few studies, as you're probably aware of, and Chicago Medical produced a study the other day where they've looked at people who were deficient. Okay, this is retrospective. So this is people who were already deficient in vitamin D who then caught the coronavirus and struggled to get over it. So there was a direct link between a lack of vitamin D and the problem with the virus, which means heading into, especially in England, place like this, where we're going to get very little sun shortly, a second wave is, I would say, almost certainty at this point. So what I'm saying is people need to stock up on vitamin D while they can.
That's a very good advice. It's very good advice, Lee. I'm following it myself. I'm taking vitamin D supplement. I can't say I like it. I actually feel, although other people don't, but I actually feel a little bit sick after I take the tablet just for a minute or so until it passes. But I figure it's far better to take the vitamin D. Get as much vitamin D as you can from the sunshine. Take it, it's over the counter. It's not particularly expensive. Shop around, you can get it quite economically. Take your vitamin D supplement. Stay as far away from as many people as you can. That much, to me, is obvious. If you don't get close enough to catch the virus from someone else, then you'll be fine. You might be extremely unlucky and pick it up from a surface. Keep washing your hand. Keep using these sanitizers that are everywhere. There are some people you can't stay away from. You can't not kiss your wife. You cannot not hug your children. And I'm not going to stop doing that. I'd rather die than do that. But as far as you can, avoid close contact with as many people as you can. I wear a mask. Not because it's going to stop me getting it, but because it will reduce the chances of me giving it to someone else. I'm selfless like that. Let's do what we can and pray to the Almighty, whom I believe in with all my heart, that this second wave is not as devastating as the first one was. I know there's a lot of people out there who don't trust the state, who don't trust the mass media, don't trust the political class. And I understand that because I don't trust them either. I told you at the beginning about this extraordinary book written by the ordinary wife of a very, very ordinary member of the political class. And it is a dismal read indeed. I know why the credibility of our rulers is so reduced. But this is not a capitalist conspiracy, because for that to be true, Cuba would have to be in on it. Communist China would have to be in on it. Communist Vietnam would have to be in on it. And they're not. It's real. It's dangerous. May God go with you all, and you stay safe enough be back with me next week at the same time, same place. It's been marvelous.